Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's happiest podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Boogish. I'm George Dimbrellis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, we have the Chair of Australian Literature at the University of Western Australia and the Director of the Westerly Research Group, a lecturer and an author, Tony Hughes-Daith. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, George.
I'm glad to hear it. Yes, you're very comfortable over there in WA, so you're sunny and bright over there.
Yeah, we're COVID-free. We're in a bubble. We're in a bubble inside a bubble.
Yeah. Look, I'm sure there's going to be straight away, you as a person who's very much, you might be the most literary person I've had on potentially. I'm guessing there's a lot of stuff coming out already about dealing with the pandemic and stuff like that in terms of literature. Is there any discussions around that yet? Or are people like, it's too soon still? We need time to figure this out.
Yeah, I'm feeling there'd be people writing all kinds of pandemic novels and, pandemic sonnet sequences or whatever it is. Probably in a publishing sense, it is a little bit soon for things to have appeared. Some have kind of uncannily predicted it, like Laura Jean McKay's novel, The Animals in That Country, which is about a kind of a pandemic, but was written before this pandemic.
Perfect timing though, right? Because that was like last year, I think you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, and that's it's a good novel by pretty sort of important young Australian novelist, and it just won the Arthur C. Clarke Science Fiction Award. It's kind of a pretty big deal, actually. It's not a huge amount of money, but that's pretty much the best science fiction broadly considered novel in the world.
That's a big deal. Like that's I didn't realize that she'd won that award. Is that? I like how you mentioned the fact it's not that much money. How much is? What's the award money for that?
It's $2,021. Like I was reading about. It was only announced yesterday, I think, or the day before. But apparently, like when it was first awarded in 1968, they awarded $1,968. And they would just increase it by a dollar a year, which isn't exactly CPI. So $2,021 is, even if it's American dollars, it's not going to get you very far.
That's criminal.
Yeah.
The highest award you can get in science fiction is $2,221. That is a slap in the – I can't believe that. That's a renowned – that's on the cover of – so many major pieces of science fiction through history
I've right.
read. Like it's like the most prestigious. So shocked by that amount. Yeah. Those dogs. Tell you what. Right, thank you for the insight. I didn't know that. Okay. Well, you've already mentioned an Australian author. So I guess you teach there at UWA. You've studied literature or variations on it your whole life. Actually, before that, let's start with the book. We'll go from the book and then we'll jump around to everything else. So what I know you picked like four to pick from, but I'm going to put pressure on you now. You're going to have to put one that I can then put in the title, even though we can mention the other ones as well. What is going to be your book of choice for today?
I'll go with Carpinteria. It's this kind of vast epic, really, that was published in 2006 by the Aboriginal writer Alexis Wright. She's been sort of an activist most of her life in the Northern Territory and kind of, I guess, Western Queensland and kind of from the Gulf country. And yeah, this book, you know, when it sort of appeared, it kind of came out of nowhere. She did have a previous novel, Plains of Promise, but yeah, it was kind of a huge deal. It was written in a kind of magical realist style, which probably has become like a world style. So you see magical realist novels really in China or Indonesia, and magical realist novels are often about really trying to bring together like the time of like the village, the old time, with contemporary modernity. You know, like so magical realism tries to make sense of that collision that's occurring all over the world in different ways, where you've got people and like living in like huts, but with smartphones, you know. So it's like, yeah, magical realism kind of tries to deal with that base, and that happens in parts of Australia as well. So yeah, it's cool. Like it's a book that you know, kind of it starts in like a, I guess a shanty town on the edge of a kind of a redneck Queensland town called Desperance, and there's kind of it's a strongly ironic novel. Like so this town Desperance was set up.
You can't call the town Desperance without it being ironic a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. there's an element of desperation that kind of flows through everyone there. But the town was set up as a port back in the colonial era. This is explained in the book, for the cattle industry. They're going to export from there. And they put this town on the edge of a kind of a river, and this river is going to be, you know, kind of conduit for the cattle and a port. But, you know, 3 or 4 years later, there's a big storm and the river just changes course dramatically and spits out another like 20 k's east. So this town is like now kind of nowhere. And so that's kind of that's a typical gesture in this novel. So people have these grand plans, they're going to do this, they're going to build a mine, they're going to, you know, and the country has other ideas, you know, it just changes its mind. So people kind of, in this book, like people live on the surface of the world, but the world's really determined by these kind of spirits underneath, and they have their own views of things. And the Aboriginal people who live there kind of get that, but the white people just really don't. I mean, getting it and dealing with it is two separate things. So the Aboriginal people are kind of just as kind of bounced around by the, you know, vicissitudes of nature as the white people, but they're a bit more accepting that this is just how the world is. So, yeah, it's just a fantastic novel in the way that kind of unfolds in these kind of crazy ways.
Yeah. I mean, that's you've mentioned it. Like, I actually never thought about the idea of magical realism being a way to show that contrast between, I guess, in many ways, more native or I don't know how to phrase the word correctly, but more ancient methods versus the shiny modernity, and like, yeah, showing that contrast. Because I guess in a weird way, now that I think about it, modernity is the magic coming into those places, and instead you're just showing the reverse of that, which is kind of capturing the same thing by having it. Yeah, I never actually thought about that before, which, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the old sort of Marxist idea was that you would sort of, you know, progress through stages. You know, you'd be like hunter-gatherers, and then you'd primitive agriculture, and then, you know, develop cities and the working class, a slave period. You kind of move through these stages and capitalism and then communism. But, yeah, I mean, the reality of the way that capitalism is kind of is much more like a virus or a kind of a pandemic. It just sort of spreads through and it just hits people, it gets inside them, changes the way they desire and all these sort of things. And, yeah, I think magical realism replaced social realism, you know, towards the end of last century as a world style to cope with that reality.
Oh, okay. So what was social realism before?
Yeah, well, social realism was another world style, really. That kind of emerged. Again, you've got, a kind of way of writing novels that appears in Europe in the kind of late 18th and early 19th century, which was trying to give expression to a new form of society. Like people weren't living in kind of feudal hierarchies anymore. They had kind of interior lives that demanded meaning, there was literacy, there was kind of change. And the novel form really kind of was attuned to that. And the novel form also represented different kind of social classes coming together in ways that kind of epic poetry and verse dramas and things like that didn't. So as that kind of unrolled around the world through colonialism, really, you got social realist novels appearing in India, in China, in South America, which were trying to do the same thing, like document the formation of societies, capitalist societies, and social novels were kind of sagas usually, or the Philippines, there are social novels there, which tried to make sense of that change process. But, yeah, I think what happened by sort of the mid to late 20th century was just the acceleration of that and the craziness of the way in which modernity was visiting the world wasn't in sort of stages, but you had this radical collision between ancient and modern, which, you're right, George, like there's kind of a magic there. You just can't, they're incommensurable.
I mean, that's a classic, was it Arthur C. Clarke that said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic? I think it might have been actually him to tie that together. I think it might have been.
I can't explain how the thing in front of me works. I mean, there's some sort of... Are you inside there, George?
Are we just voices coming out of someone that we could be made up now? Someone could be listening to us and neither of us exist. That's some freshman uni stuff right there, I think. To go back to that, though, for a second, and this might just show my lack of knowledge, but I hope I'm not the only one. So magical realism, in terms of what it is essentially... where it's the real world still, but there's just hints or elements of magic in it. So it's not overbearing. It's not fantasy. That's kind of how I would summarize magical realism in my head. So if that's wrong, let me know. But how do you define something as social realism? That's what I was kind of trying to say. How do you define that?
Yeah, the different ways. I mean, one of the ways you could distinguish it is that, what we might say in my sort of area is like causality. Like in social realism, economics determines things. So a factory comes along and, a company comes along, opens a factory, starts to pollute an area, people have to change their lives, they lose their livelihoods, they end up working in the factory. But it would obey rules which we regard as rational. In magical realism, you have magical causality. To take the example from Alexis Wright's Carpentaria, like you end up with basically like a dual causality, like rivers in Australia, particularly like the Gulf country, where you've got very high volumes of water across very flat country, they change course all the time. Happens all the time. Even my parents like grew up in Carnarvon in Western Australia, and that the Gascoyne River just changed course after a cyclone and spat out, another kilometre away from where it used to. So that happens all the time, and that's kind of, we would regard that as a natural process. But in Alexis Wright's novel, that's that change of water course is the choice of the creation spirit. So and that's allowed to sort of exist as a reason. That's how the river changed course. On the one hand, it's a natural thing, but another thing, it's a spiritual thing. So magical realism often that's a case where the events are probably equally explicable, but sometimes things happen in novels. Like there's a scene where the police officer who's kind of having a kind of dodgy affair with one of the girls in the shanty town, and he's driving his car out and the car suddenly gets enveloped in spider web. Is that happening? Is he having a delusion? How does he get out? We're not sure, but that's just sort of what happens, So things like that, wouldn't appear in a social realist novel. You don't get a guy driving along and suddenly have his car covered up by giant spiders and spider webs, So when that first started happening, it was quite a shock. It was quite scandalous. Like I mean, the person who's generally credited with popularizing the mode of magical realism was Marquez, the Colombian writer. And, but yeah, it quickly kind of took hold. I mean, you could also, you know, writers like Günter Grass or whatever was writing in a similar sort of time, but it really got, really took off in the Anglophone world with Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. And since then, yeah, there, as I've said, there are examples all throughout the world literature.
Yeah. I mean, that's a, to go off of that, I love that I'm talking to an actual literature, the chair of the Australian Literature for UW, so you can explain things to me. So, because I read Midnight's Children, I got to say that, like, and I think I was too young and I was too inexperienced because I never studied literature. That book was very difficult for me to wrap my head around reading it. And like, just in terms of what was kind of, it just didn't fit any sort of box that I could kind of put it in. It was very difficult for me to deal with, kind of, just because it felt very much about something other than what you were reading. like very much so. And I didn't mind it, but it was rich, evocative in terms of how it portrayed things. But yeah, I was quite confused through it. And I've heard the Satanic Verse is even more difficult to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that happens in, I haven't read Satanic Verses, but Midnight's Children, like one of the things that's perplexing about that novel is just, it just starts. And actually, if you read Midnight's Children, and it's the same is also true of Carpentier, if you read it and then go back immediately after you've finished and read the first two chapters again, that makes sense. So in other words, what confuses you is that the first two chapters or whatever happen as if they've explained it all to you, but they haven't. So mm-hmm. They're mentioning names and people and things. You've got no idea what you're talking. I missed the memo. Did I come late to this? And basically, that's what, again, in a funny sort of way or formal way, that's another way in which magical realism represents the onset of modernity. You know, it's not explained to you. There isn't a kind of subcommittee that gets delegation that gets sent ahead to your village. Would you like to sign up to capitalism? It has this kind of advantages and these kind of disadvantages. It's totally up to you. Like, it just arrives, you know, bang, bang, bang. And they took, like, capitalism is talking capitalism, and you're trying to catch up frantically with its new entire rewriting of human value.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that actually that's a valid point, I guess. I mean, if that's a choice, it's so funny how, like, I, as a reader, I'm always like, is this a choice they're doing it like this? But, I mean, that's a very valid reading of that, I guess, if they want to capture that feeling. Again, it's above my pay grade of knowledge of how to read this stuff. So I find it interesting to hear this stuff. With the Carpentaria, and I guess you've mentioned it a few times now in terms of magical realism, I guess, but you've got the capitalism impact there on kind of unbridled excess and how it impacts everywhere and kind of doesn't give you a say in it. Is there, I guess, actually, firstly, is that something you've always felt? Was that something you grew into? Were you striding against capitalism when you were younger and all that? Or is it just an appreciation of just where we are now and looking around, I guess?
I mean, I wasn't like born a Marxist or anything like that. Like, you know, I like everyone else, I grew up inside, well, not everyone else, but like everyone in the developed world, at least, like I grew up inside capitalism. I think I did have a view that I didn't understand the world I was living in, and it didn't make sense. And I did feel I was as a child and really, throughout my adolescence and early adulthood, quite acutely conscious or had the strong feeling that everyone knew what was going on and I didn't, you know, like the world wasn't, you know, like I was seeing the same things as everyone, but I didn't have the same feeling of it making sense that they seem to evince, you know. So, perhaps that did send me down a particular path of intellection, you know, like of trying to explain things or think about why things are the way they are. And maybe it does make me sort of a bit more, attuned to feeling, you know, that there's a system in play which happens kind of before we arrive, and we arrive into it, and pretend we know what's going on. I mean, mostly unconscious of that. So, yeah, I mean, and when I see that in novels, you know, like Carpentier, I recognize it, I guess. So it's not like I go in looking for, I mean, using capitalism as a kind of shorthand. I mean, you call it colonialism or you call it, I mean, whatever you want to call it. Like, it's clearly what's making the world go round at the moment, for the most part. So, but yeah, what you see in magical realism is what this looks like from the village, you know. Yeah, it's not like they have their own systems for understanding things. You know, they assimilate it as best they can, and they're also changed by it. So you get this kind of encounter, I think, in magical realism.
Yeah. No, that's a and in the end, everything gets subsumed by whatever it is. Capitalism is a shorthand for it, but yes, this globalization, I don't know. It's funny, although, and also just a note, that does kind of sound like you were born a Marxist, just a little bit.
I definitely, if someone was doing the quality control on that, they would have definitely put a little a note on me.
Yeah.
Propensity.
Ticking a few cliches of being the literary head of a university. It's like, you're everything the right wing is worried about. So I guess, and so many things I want to ask about. Okay, let's start with this. Firstly, focusing specifically on the book and just very one aspect of it, in terms of the writing, because you, again, looking at this from someone who's got such a vast experience in literature, essentially. So I might be putting you too highly on a pedestal here. So tell me if I'm wrong and you don't know what's going on, but I feel like you would be able to appreciate, so what makes, does that part stand out in Carpentier as well? Is that something that's noticeable or distinct, or is that more
the writing?
It's just good. Yeah. It's just good. And the actual thematic and storytelling is actually the best part.
Yeah. The writing is quite striking. It's a mixture of things. Like there are passages within it which are utterly beautiful. There is a strange way in which words are kind of, to my sort of pedantic way of thinking, misused. And I wondered about the way the editors kind of just let some of that just be, you know, just slight odd usages of words. I kind of like the way it hasn't been regularized. It's raw, and I don't want to kind of in any way downplay the brilliance of this book. Like, it is in almost every way you could esteem a book. I think this is a great book, book. Like, it's beautiful, its conception, its profundity, but also the lyricism of the writing is, you know, there are times that it's quite mesmerizing. You can go through a 20 or 30 page passage where, you know, maybe one of the characters is on the Gulf at night on a boat, you know, being kind of talked to by magical fish and stars, and it's dazzling and hypnotic, and you feel yourself kind of borne away. I think the writing is, I've not seen anything quite like it in Australia. So, but it's challenging as well. Like, it's not, it's easy to get lost in the book. And I think the way I tend to think of that is the book is, it's non-Cartesian, you know, it doesn't happen in kind of, normal forms of space and time, you know. It kind of happens in these other more elliptical ways of being.
Right. Okay. I mean, that's I'm super intrigued now, because I've got to be honest, for me, it is a black mark on my reading, and I've tried to up it recently. I've got a few more that I've done, but my Australian literature side of things is not as deep as it should be, which I think probably a lot of people say the same sort of stuff. So I'll definitely, like, you've sold me on this. I want to check it out. But as you're describing that, and this is, I almost don't want to go into this because it might sound off-putting to people who might want to read the book as well, or like thinking about it. But this kind of can speak to you as well, because basically you've studied literature. Again, you're the head of the chair of literature for the UWA. So I'm guessing you're always deep into books from young. Is that a fair assumption?
I mean, I wasn't what you'd call a voracious reader. Like my mum and my sister will just read books, you know, I guess you would, you know, you would say they're sort of trashy books or whatever, but they just keep reading them. They always, then they just go through them, churn through them. I was always like a slow reader, you know, so things would always take, and I still am really. So I'm of a light company. Terry is a big commitment for me. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's going to take me a couple of weeks to sort of work through it. But so, yeah, I've always been attracted to language and literature, but yeah, in terms of the different kinds of readers, I'm probably like a sort of a slow reader who sort of sits with it and kind of moves along at my own pace. I mean, even a novel like this, I'm being forced in my current position to be a bit more, you know, like current. But often I trail along. Like, I really only got into this book probably sort of 10 years after it was published, and maybe I also get kind of put off by hype and
yeah. Oh, who doesn't?
I like it all to settle so down a little bit, and then
so disappointing, and then some of it. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in this case, it's like it's not. But you want to be able to kind of come to your own appreciation without being forced to. So, yeah, it was worth the wait. I have always been interested in books, but I think I've always been, I said, not like this hungry, voracious reader. But I think more than books, I suppose I'm interested in meaning, and books have meaning in them, and. And I think I'm also interested in, like, you know, as I sort of hinted before, like the parts of life that people don't talk about, you know, that are just sort of not necessarily because they're embarrassed, but maybe a little bit, but mainly because they're just hard to talk about. They don't fit sort of categories. And I find, like, that's what I like about literature, because literature you can read and there'll be a moment in a poem or something like that, and you're like, yeah, I have had that feeling. No one's ever named it before, but you just have, you know. So I kind of look for those sort of, yeah, that's kind of what drives me in my encounter with literature. It's a kind of truth, really, but it's not captured anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And I guess, like, as part of that, and this is where I find it interesting, because even with Carpentarian, I'm not saying I don't know where it fits into the, like, into the scheme of things, but essentially, like, I think there's, like, quite a big shift. How to say this? Again, basically, you've got plot novels, and then you've got literary novels, which sometimes can be quite loose, not as plot-based and more about moments or language or themes, like you're saying. And it sounds like those were always the ones that appealed to you, even when you were younger. There wasn't like a development towards it. You always kind of preferred those maybe ones there. Is that a fair thing to say, or is that...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean I'm saying? Am I making
sense? I think so, yeah. I mean... Because people always, whenever I'm reading something, they say, "What's it about?" And you're right. Some books aren't really paraphrasable in that way. Like, you can't just say what they're about. I guess I'm attracted to books where I don't know what they're going to be about. Or to put that in the opposite way, like I'm turned off by books where I know what's going to happen. After I've read the first paragraph, I'm like, I know where this is going. And again, like that makes me a bit strange. A lot of people like that, and again, like sometimes, you know, genres. You know, some people like, oh, I like dragons and whatever, or I like crime novels, or you know, I like historical romance, or you know, some people have kind of, yeah, I kind of.
I mean, yeah. I feel vaguely dismissed. Yeah, you know, people like dragons or whatever.
Look, I don't mind your dragon.
Myself, I take umbrage to this, but kids.
Yeah, look, I like the Game of Thrones just as much as the next person, but you know. But I suppose when I'm sitting down to read a book, I'm looking for something different. And but you know, oddly enough, like you know, in something like Carpentaria, quite a lot happens. Like, there is a lot of plot. You know, they're crazy things. It would take you a long time to describe everything that happened. Sorry, there is plot, but it's not plot probably in the way that you mean of a marriage plot or you know, sort of a crime plot or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I'm doing stuff because it's interesting to me. And again, I always wonder where nature versus nurture, all that stuff. But essentially, it seems to me like a lot of book readers seem to slowly, like, and that's what I'm wondering. Some seem to gravitate that way, but a lot just seem to like it when it's like the ones who are the most avid that I've had on as well. They seem to be the ones that like really like the stuff which is a bit I don't know. It's weird saying literary because you can have literary works which are more plot driven, but essentially like that, yeah, where it's more less easy to define. Let's put it that way. Yeah, more thematic and stuff like that, I guess.
I kind of want to be surprised.
Like, yeah.
And yeah, the more you read, the harder it is to be surprised. So yeah, you do kind of. It's like a kind of, I don't know, it's maybe like a thrill seeking thing where you kind of like, whoa, I've not seen that before, you know, and that's what I kind of live for when I read. I mean, the good thing about my job is like, sometimes I'll be teaching a book because it seems like I should, like it fits the thing, and I wouldn't have chosen it maybe, but then I do read it and it's really good. So I'm not always the best judge of these things. Like I believe in arranged marriages.
That's true. They were less of a commitment though. Yeah. No. So, yeah, just because I guess I'm currently going through this journey myself a little bit weirdly. I recently, even though I'm far too late to the party and it's considered so, there's a specific type of person that enjoys it, but I recently actually sat down and read some David Foster Wallace for the first time, who I know is American, not Australian, all that, but it made me like, I've now started going through all of his writings in terms of which is quite dense, some of it. And I was like, and because he's got nonfiction where he actually talks about what he's doing in a way, it's actually making me just have a new appreciation for that more complex literature, which I always dabbled with, but I never really like sat down and, yeah, because it can be a slog sometimes. But I feel like it's, especially with him, I was reading, I was like, this is, yeah, it's something I've never seen before, I guess, for me. Yeah. So that's why I'm going through this journey myself. That's why I find it interesting.
I was pretty, I was also pretty late to that party. And I've only read Infinite Jest, but that's quite a long book, and that was pretty involved. I liked it too. Yeah. Oh, no, that's not true. I read the posthumous novel, which was about like a tax department in Georgia, like not. You know, not the immediate kind of subject of literature. But, yeah, I liked him as well. I mean, the parts of him which feel a bit twee. But then, there are moments which are kind of just heartbreaking as well. So, yeah, I think he's he's a kind of a wild writer. That you can, you feel like you are on a, you're in a different planet, and they do things differently there.
That's what I mean. So I obviously they're all different. So I'm not saying they're the same at all. But yes, it seems like that's why I'm more primed right now to appreciate, let's say, a novel like Carpentaria potentially than I was 6 months ago because of it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So alongside that, actually, firstly, since we didn't really clarify it, so what exactly is it you do there at UWA? What's kind of your role in general?
Well, in general, I'm a lecturer in literature, so with a specialty in Australian literature. So on a day-to-day basis, like I teach a variety of courses. Like I teach quite a lot of screen texts. I teach a unit called Netflix, FLICKS. Cinema and long form television. So, and we just look at the drama that occurs in televisual form. So,
all right. So, not book related. That's
Right. I mean, again, like as I said, I do like books, but I'm actually just interested in meaning. So, and I also feel like you know, I want to be where meaning is happening. And if, you know, if I was living in the 16th century, maybe that would be like the Globe Theatre or something like that. But right here, right now, 2021, a lot of that's happening in streaming services. And, yeah, there's some pretty high quality narratives and stories, story worlds kind of emerging there. So I enjoyed that. Yeah, it's a different kind of text and way to work with things. I also teach kind of literature and the environment, and I'm kind of really interested in the relationship between literature and place. So, I mean, the book that I wrote maybe a couple of years ago was about the wheat belt of Western Australia and how that was formed. And I kind of told the story of the creation of the wheat belt in WA through the 20th century through the lens of creative writing about it. So I kind of used literature as like as a kind of witness to the event of the wheat belt. So that's another kind of thing that I'm really interested in, and probably an area that kind of approach defines me in a certain sort of way in terms of how I approach Australian literature. And I think that's probably how I'd be known by my colleagues in the field of Australian literature as someone who's interested in place and literature.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I feel as you're saying that, and I was going to bring up the fact that you'd written that book, because it does look it sounds like, because those are other people's, like, different creative writing pieces from different people throughout the years, and you've kind of put them together to show the wheat belt and how it's changed over that time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Firstly, I guess, actually, before, what's the wheat belt?
Yeah, so, like, yeah, it's a term we use in WA, but, I mean, in a sense, every state has what you call as a wheat belt, which is it's basically a grain-growing region. So what normally defines a grain-growing region in Australia is a rainfall kind of line. So in WA, so to get wheat growing, you don't want too much water, and you want it to fall at the right time, you don't want too little. So basically in WA and probably all over Australia, the wheat belts that appeared firstly in South Australia, Western New South Wales, Northern Victoria, South Western Queensland, they're basically between the 10 and 20-inch rainfall line. So those are all wheat belts in the sense that there's a belt of rain that's optimal for the growing of annual crops. So in West Australia, that was like the southwest, really. So there's a kind of if you just like Google Earth Australia, you'll notice like a sharp line running basically between Geraldton and Esperance, and everything to the sort of southwest of that, except for the very coastal fringe, is kind of the wheat belt. So that's an area of land that's probably as large as Britain. And that was all cleared in probably two 30-year periods in the 20th century, from 1900 to 1930, and then immediately after the war from, say, 45 to 75. So my book wasn't really like how the wheat belts changed, but more like how the hell did we get the wheat belt? You know, like it's a sudden event. Like what this stuff's like the bush that was cleared, that's been there for millions of years. Like we haven't had glaciers or volcanic eruptions or anything. It's just as the continents drifted around, these same species have been growing and becoming more diverse. So like biodiversity of the southwest of WA is like the equivalent of a rainforest canopy, you know. It's like there's an incredible amount of species, and that was just sort of bulldozed out of existence. And I tried to, I guess, change the time scheme where that, instead of being, generations of farming, checkerboard of fields, you know, kind of natural, I said, like, this is like a shocking, sudden, violent event. Again, I tried to take advantage of literature's capacity to say things that aren't said otherwise to register that event.
I mean, it's when you think of it in that scale, the size of Britain and like natural diversity and just destroyed. It's hard to like. Yes, progress is great, but it is. It's hard to look at that and see it's a good thing. So on that note, because you're talking about that, I noticed that, yes, you do have an interesting environment, and then your choice of Carpentaria as well, and some of the other books which we can go into at some point as well, with Indigenous communities. It's funny that your the things you like, especially in literature, really seem very Australian literature. Is that a fair thing to say? Like, as in, I feel like an interest in both the land and in Indigenous communities. I know that's probably, there's a lot of places, maybe I'm showing my own Australia-centric view, but I feel like those are two issues that are very, very much a part of Australian culture in a way, because it's such, both for crimes we're committing against it even now, but like, it feels like that is a big part of it. Is that a fair thing to say? I don't even know if that's accurate about Australian literature, and like, I don't know, can you speak to that? Is that something that you noticed yourself? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, actually. That they are kind of central elements of Australian literature. And I mean, why they're central elements of Australian literature is reflective really of Australia's history as a settler colony. So settler colonies are a kind of forms of colonies that are built by appropriating land. So basically, what you get in the settler colony is, you know, people moving in from another country, they're taking land that belongs to Indigenous people, and they set up their farms and whatever else. And that's the way the colonization sort of proceeds. I mean, there are other kinds of colonies, like plantations and whatever, but that's the way settler colonies worked in Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, and South Africa. So it began with land, and it kind of it remains with land. Obviously, there's all sorts of ways in which there's a kind of contest of belonging in which land is still central. So as people come from other countries, again, like from England, particularly in Ireland, the kind of initial, I guess, Anglo-Celtic migration pattern that defined settler colonialism in Australia till 1950 or whatever, that was a contest over land in a material sense, but then it also became a contest of who belongs in the country. And so there was a whole mythology that was developed in Australia around connection to land. The problem is that we stole it. So that's the major problem, right? So that's a key dynamic in Australian literature. It does have the effect, which can't be entirely accidental, of kind of sidelining Australia as a migrant country in the post-war period, you know. And there's a great essay by Nalmalay. Yeah, I'll explain. I'll let Nalmalay explain, because he explains it quite well, I think, and then I can spin it if need be. But he says, like, I think it was Text did a series of writers on writers, and Nalmalay was asked to. He's a Vietnamese Australian writer, famous for a book called The Boat. So he's a smart guy, right? Like he's a lawyer, and then he went to go and took up like the most prestigious writing program in America. Oddly enough, it's called the Iowa Writers Program. It's one of the first that was created in America in the 60s, I think. So a lot of, you know, great up and coming hot young authors go there, and he went there. And but he's kind of got a bit quiet, must be said. But so it was a bit surprising when this came out, maybe last year or the year before. So Nalmalay's asked to write on David Malouf. Malouf has written the kind of Australian literature that I've just described, you know, about, you know, being in Australia, setting colonial times, and
the settler's connection to the land rather than anyone else's.
Yeah, exactly. Settler connection to land, encounters with Aboriginal people. So these kind of things, you know, that provide some of the central coordinates for Australian literature. And Nalmalay's kind of, his approach was, first of all, to say, well, I can't remember. He went to Geelong Grammar or some fancy school in Melbourne as like a scholarship kid, and he disdained Australian literature. He was forced to study it. It wasn't real literature. They were much better. Him and his friend had kind of lists of who were the best. And when he came across Malouf, he was like, actually, this guy's all right. Like, this guy can actually write. But then, you know, he sort of explained a little bit more about his life and then how he's often forced to explain himself, you know, as like, you know, someone who was taken in as part of the Vietnamese kind of migrant intake and all that sort of thing. And Harry now, in reflection, probably in his late 30s, I don't know how old he is exactly, kind of thinks about Maloof and Maloof's concern with these things. And he says, well, for us who are non-white Australians, like the way the Australians regard the bush as this kind of hostile thing that they have to fight and overcome, that's how we regard whiteness. Like, whiteness is our bush. So it's sort of like, yeah, that was a kind of a nice decentering of that basic thing. But, yeah, in terms of me, myself, like, I probably have stayed in that basic set of coordinates around land and environment and that now in a post-Mabo context is and has to be also, you know, encounters with Aboriginal people and what the hell they think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rich topic, don't get me wrong, firstly. Like, obviously, like both the Indigenous rights and the environmental rights, and it's something which is relevant always, especially here in Australia. On that point, actually, two different things. Firstly, is your background, like, with your family, like, are you 50 generations back Australian? Is that something which is, like, part of you as well? Like, I'm just wondering if that fed into it or something like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit – no one is. Like, you might be you'd be doing well to trace one tiny kind of filament, you know, four generations in Australia as a settler, right? But, I mean, on my dad's side, no, he was just – he just migrated, like, after the war from England with his parents. On my mum's side, she was actually born in Hong Kong, which is a bit strange, but her dad was born in Wagen, which is a wheat belt town. So, and she will often kind of invoke various ancestors that have been in Western Australia for, you know, since the 1830s or whatever. But it doesn't mean myself, like I had my own personal experience was actually one of moving a lot as a child. Like my father worked for the Department of Defense, and I was kind of, I went to like 10 different schools in three countries. And so I always felt kind of like dislocated, you know. And I think I did, and I guess with my own sort of like, kind of white privilege and the fact that I was born in Australia, kind of I always had that in my that I could call on, and no one could say I didn't have it. But also I felt like it was completely empty, like it didn't contain anything, nothing meaningful. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere, because, you know, I lived in Canberra, Sydney, Melbourne, Munich, Washington, D.C., Perth, and, you know, and every year I was at a new school and meeting new people. So I just, at a subjective level, I felt that I didn't belong anywhere. And I think at a subjective level, that's probably what's driven me to do this kind of thing, you know, to sort of, it is a sort of a root-seeking thing. And I'm aware of the problems of that and, you know, that I come up against some basic, you know, violence and contradiction and in Australia's story.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess that's interesting. Yeah, looking, fascination, the most rooted of, like, things, which is, like, obviously the land and the Indigenous communities' relationship with it, which, yeah, it's also funny that I guess it's technically you're just as much of a migrant as Nam, by the sound of it, coming in as well. Actually, just quickly, on a slight tangent from this, I was kind of guessing about the fact that this is, like, a very Australian type of literature, because, like, you know, I would look at, like, what would be an example of, like, a UK type of literature? Is there one, like, as clear kind of as this, or is there one for, like, America, or, like, I feel like America would be probably their most distinct features, maybe the African-American side of things. But, like, yeah, I don't know. Does UK have something like that where you're, like, look at it, you're like, oh, these are very British things they're dealing with? Are they also dealing with the guilt of colonialism but from the people back home?
They don't feel guilty. As far as I can tell, they actually blame us. Like, God, you guys are terrible. I was like, no, actually, that was you. look, there's a clear what I think the where you find the pattern actually is set of colonial literatures, and whether that's South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, they all have a version, and then even you see it in South American literature in a certain sort of way, like a version of kind of land-based literature. So again, I think that's not accidental. The material conditions were land-based. That's what created the rationale for the colonization, and the literature is land-based. I mean, I guess typically an English type novel is class-based, and that's a And that's what you tend to notice a little bit in English novels, is that the presence of class, like even something like D.H. Lawrence, you know, you kind of, there's the feeling of the working class, like what, you know, it's a sense of being kind of abject or excluded or kind of,
yeah. You know,
always feeling kind of too big for your boots if the minute you step out of your place. So I think that tends to typify British literature. Again, I'm speaking in wild generalizations.
Ah, they're not all thinking doing the same thing. I think that could always
be. Yeah, but even something like, you know, Agatha Christie, you know, there's a sort of sense of a country house and a hierarchical society. And then you have writers like, you know, like Ishiguro, who's sort of has a Japanese origin but lived in Britain most of his life. And he writes kind of very kind of self-consciously and parodically English novels. Which again, the key thing is not place so much as class. Mm. But, yeah, in Australia we pretend we're classless and we invest imaginatively in place.
No. I mean, and, like, maybe we were slightly less so, especially 50 years ago, or maybe when these people were writing, the class side of things was – And I mean, and also I think, I mean, Australia as a land is, it, like, I know everywhere's unique, but Australia is, like, especially unique as a land. Like, as in, it's almost another planet compared to almost anywhere else on the planet. Like, as in, it's so separate, and it's, like, just from its flora and fauna, both are just, like, they just developed their own stream for who knows how long. It feels very distinct in its own way, which I guess you could probably say about every continent, but it just, Australia feels a bit different. I don't know. Like, what the hell are kangaroos?
I always think that, yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. No, you're right. I think that's true. I mean, in all sorts of ways, it has a kind of, even in terms of human societies, but yeah, biotically and geologically, it is actually ancient. You know? So in ways that, again, are probably inconceivable for most Europeans, like, I mean, most of Northern Europe and most of Northern America was covered by an ice sheet until about 10,000 years ago. So that's like not even in existence, not visible, you know. So it's mostly, you know, what they regard as their ancient forests and so on are just sort of opportunistic weeds that colonized it, you know, in very recent time, like by Australian, you know, this stuff, it's so recent. So there's often a complete misunderstanding. And again, colonists to Australia have kind of they've struggled to comprehend the age of Australia, and they tended to regard it as either kind of lost in the mists of time or incredibly young, you know, just suddenly, you know, because only Europeans only kind of stumbled onto it like a couple hundred years ago. But yeah, it is unique in lots of ways, and then we've got this odd situation of a kind of I guess Anglo culture, part of the Anglo world in Asia, more or less, or the Asia Pacific region, and so there's all sorts of weirdness around that as well.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting developing relationship that is, yeah, it's going to redefine what Australian is in another 50 years, surely. That closeness, actually, because of the books you selected as well, and you've mentioned it a few times in terms of the Indigenous communities and stuff like that, one of the other works you mentioned was Black Work, which you might have brought up as a favorite, which looks like it kind of tackles that side of things. Is that right?
That's a book by Alison Whitaker. She's a lawyer, legal scholar, and a poet. And I really love this book. Yeah, it's maybe from 2017 or something, but just been getting into it recently. And again, it's quite challenging sort of book. It's kind of what we call language poetry, which I think all poetry is language poetry, but language poetry, as it's called, as a movement going back in America in the sort of late 60s, kind of made language kind of visible. So it's some of her poems are written, not in conventional lines. They'll be sort of kicked to one side or in intersecting kind of columns and things like that. So on the page, it looks a bit forbidding or kind of confusing. There's some brilliant moments in it. Like she's got these poems and they're basically based on legal judgments. So there's one on the Trevorrow case, which was a stolen children's case in South Australia. Another one on the Mizdu case, which is a death in custody that happened in Geraldton, terrible case in West Australia, and then the Mabo case. And the poem consists of this. The title says, 49 most commonly occurring three-word phrases in these legal judgments or legal accounts. And so it just lists them. So in order of frequency, three words from, say, the Mabo judgment. So it's just done by a computer. Computers kind of pick this out, and you'll get these phrases listed. I don't know why she chose 49. Maybe she says somewhere, but the 49 most in order. And it's just so uncanny, these three words. First of all, it reads like poetry, actually. It reads like beautiful poetry, created completely by a computer set to work on a legal judgment. And the reason why it works as kind of poetry is like, the phrases, three words is just enough to kind of evoke something. And there'll be sort of recurrent concepts like appropriation, stolen, land, injury. And you get all these kind of words that are law's way of speaking about the historical injustices of Aboriginal people. Their way of because law addresses harm, so it's their way of designating the harm that's occurred in legal language so that it can be processed by the law, and then various languages that then convert those to legal ideas and then forms of redress. So those three-word things create a kind of picture, and it's absolutely uncanny how with only a tiny bit of imagination – you read those the list of three-word phrases, and how closely it outlines, very precisely, the relationship of Aboriginal people to the Australian legal system. So it's you wouldn't think something so simple would produce such a decisive picture. So I thought that was just a stroke of absolute genius on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's kind of devastating because you're like, like in the Miss Do case, like quite a lot of the commonly used words are just a redaction, which is usually a police officer's name or something like that. So you get these black boxes as one of the, recurrent. So even that's quite eloquent in its own sort of way. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, I could be wrong about this. I mean, there's this guy who's been charged in South Australia, I think might be in trouble, but I don't think there's been anyone actually convicted, a police ever convicted of killing an Aboriginal person in Australia. So, But that's just one thing that she does in that book. It does all sorts of other things. She does a really cool rereading of the kind of iconic and sort of cliched now Australian poem, My Country by Dorothea McKellar, which is like, I love a sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains, rugged mountain ranges, droughts and flooding plains. You know, so it's kind of that, a kind of Qantas ad of Australian cliches, which she sort of, kind of tweaks and twists and instead of calling it a love of country, she calls it a love like Dorothea's. Like, she wishes she had a love like Dorothea's. I just think it's really, it's smart poetry. It's challenging. It's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, that does sound, yeah, it sounds, I might need a bit of practice before I can properly unpack that one. it sounds like really good. Did the Indigenous side of things, was that another part that came hand in hand with your environmental care of Australia, or was it like something that was on its own, or like, because obviously one kind of goes with the other, but I do wonder that, and that'll probably be the last thing we do before I've left you here for an hour. Hopefully it's not too long for you, but do those two things kind of go hand in hand with you, or was it kind of just separate?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they, I'm trying to imagine how that I think in terms of, I mean, I think the important thing about Aboriginal writing is it's really nothing to do with me. Like they've announced themselves. Like, you know, like all I've done, and I'm not alone, is just, you know, listened. Like, so, like, it's not like they needed any help from me. Like, they've come, and like Alexis Wright just writes the novel, Alza Whitaker. That, so, you know, in terms of living in Australia now, it's just, you know, if you're doing my job, which is like trying to keep some kind of finger on the pulse of Australian literature and where it's all going, that's just a massive thing right now. I mean, it's been building. It's had a few couple of generations, I think. But, I mean, right now there's just an amazing amount of, Indigenous writing. And it's not just Indigenous writing. There's Indigenous publishing, Indigenous editors, you know, so it's kind of, and there's a full Indigenous intelligentsia now. They argue amongst themselves. I'm kind of, you know, I'm listening, I'll talk, got Indigenous friends and so on that debate these things with, but, you know, it's kind of happening. The environment thing, again, that's something that's been a kind of a settler obsession and it hasn't gone, but it now has to contend with the fact that it was always part of the appropriation and not to the side of it, you know, like the appreciation of nature was kind of had a proprietary dimension. So I guess just, you know, ethically and of where we stand right now, they do go hand in hand.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like you can't enjoy nature now without feeling guilty, which I don't think is fair. Like, you know, it's fair in terms of, yes, it's to be aware of, but I feel like, yeah, it sounds, you know, it sounds like you've almost ruined environment appreciation for yourself. You're like, this is, now I know what this is
built. I don't think it needs to be that way, honestly, and I don't think most Aboriginal people would want that either. It's just kind of, there's a bit of a process, you know. You just got to, I mean, it's hard, you know, you can't go traveling without feeling guilty. You can't drive a car without feeling guilty. So in some ways, we acknowledge our complicity in these things and we're involved in processes. But, like, I mean, that the gift of a novel like Carpentaria is, like, the country's big. It's bigger than us. It will make its own decisions, you know. Try not to kind of mess it up too much, but, like, it's bigger than you. And, you know, just show a bit of deference to it. That's probably the key thing. And I guess some of the language that's kind of emerged around that is just around, like, custodianship. Like, these are custodians of the land. Just sort of makes sense that, you know, I can go over to your house. I can appreciate it. I can not feel guilty because you've invited me in and whatever. But it's your house. So,
I mean, look, I think, I don't know. I'm living there too now, so I definitely think deference is appropriate, but it's like, and there's a different kind of love and attachment. That's all I feel like. I don't know. It could feel a bit too selling yourself, your involvement in it. Like, let me put it this way. You want to get the people on board who might be at risk of finding that off-putting, I feel like. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to make it so, if you fully appreciate this, that means you don't get to feel comfortable ever in this land because you're not meant to be here. Like, and that's why I kind of push back against that as an idea. Even if there might be some truth to it in some weird way, I feel like it's not, I think there's other ways to look at it as well. Cause that's kind of where I'm coming from when I say, I don't know if we should phrase things totally like that because.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had to, I didn't have to, but after I wrote my book about the wheat belt, I went out to the wheat belt and, you know, gave talks in all the wheat belt towns and not everything I said was flattering, really, or it wasn't like a big. I mean, all the wheat belt shires in the sort of you know, had these their histories they'd written about themselves, and they're quite celebratory, and mine wasn't exactly like that. And yeah, I wondered how that would go down, you know. But yeah, people were okay, you know, that they did take issue with some things, but I mean, that's why I think why literature is important, because it's just it speaks to a certain kind of truth. We just have to look at that truth. I mean, what we do with that's kind of, you know, up for debate, but first of all, just got to see how things are, and I think literature has that capacity to just sort of show something. Like, it is the case that for you to have your farm, you had to destroy a kind of an ecosystem which had been there for millions of years. Many of those species are now extinct and will never live again. How do you balance that up against the fact that you've got a farm? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I did have people coming to me after I give these talks and they'd effectively be asking me, Tony, was it worth it? Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know if it's worth it or not. But that's what happened. That's where we are. Yeah.
It's true. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to. Yeah. I just put the whole guilty thing is sometimes can be overplayed. That's all. But I get what you mean. I definitely get what you mean about you got to at least acknowledge what actually happened, though, as part of whatever you're talking about. But you still don't have to feel adrift as a person just because that is part of your history, I guess, is my thing about that. I don't know. It's a complicated thing, which we're not going to be able to cover in this kind of podcast. That does, but I feel like we should probably call it there. We've kind of jumped all around the place, but this has been as kind of literary as I hoped it would be. So thank you very much for that, Tony. Is there anything you want to give a shout out to, I guess, before I close off? Anything at all?
Nah, that's good. I apologize. I probably did. I jumped all over the place and, but certainly I guess, just on your last point, no, I definitely don't want. I'm not trading in guilt, and I don't like it, and I don't see any real value in that. You know, I'm much more interested in truth, and then we figure out the rest from there. So literature just has that capacity, I think, for saying things that can't be said otherwise, and then what we do with it, you know, argue that out over a beer or whatever.
Mm. No, that's a good point. Okay, cool. Well, thanks very much for being on.
No worries. Thanks for having me, George.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.